the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. James M. Cain, who died in 1977, published his first novel in 1934. The Postman Always Rings Twice is one of the seminal works in American fiction, and along with Cain's Double Indemnity and Mildred Pierce, placed James M. Cain alongside Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler in the pantheon of hard-boiled crime novelists. My guest, Charles Ardai, is a novelist, as well as the founder and editor of Hard Case Crime, a publishing company dedicated to this type of novel, both old and new. Hard Case Crime has just published The Cocktail Waitress, a previously undiscovered James M. Cain novel. Charles Ardai, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
So how did you discover, how did you find The Cocktail Waitress?
It's a long and complicated story, the short version of which is that there's a novelist named Max Allen Collins, who's probably best known as the author of Road to Perdition, which became the Paul Newman Tom Hanks movie. And he's a big fan of Cain, as am I.
He was also the author of the Dick Tracy comic strip for a while.
That's right, for more than 10 years, the Dick Tracy newspaper comic strip.
And, of course, Ms. Tree, one of our favorite characters.
And, in fact, we published a prose novel about Ms. Tree in Hard Case Crime. So it's all coming full circle. When we didn't even exist yet, this was probably 2 years before we started Hard Case Crime, I was talking to Max saying, I have this idea for a line of books. I'd love for you to write for it. But while we're looking into what books to publish, do you have any suggestions? And he said, well, you should publish Cain. I said, I love Cain. I'd love to publish Cain. But everything Cain ever wrote was published. Not so, he said. There's one book that he wrote at the very end of his life. He knew about it because Cain gave an interview, which was quoted in his biography, about having finished a book called The Cocktail Waitress, but it never got published. That was more than a decade ago, and I began searching for The Cocktail Waitress. Sure enough, Cain had mentioned it in an interview, but no one had the manuscript. His estate didn't have it. His agent didn't have it. No other agent I contacted had it. No scholar had it. No collector had it. And I was stymied. But eventually, I was out in Hollywood talking to my Hollywood agent, a guy named Joel Gottler, and Joel mentioned that he had inherited the files of another agent, an old-time agent named H.N. Swanson, who had represented all the East Coast novelists when they went west to try their fortune in Hollywood, people like Faulkner and Fitzgerald and James M. Cain. And when my agent mentioned that, I immediately said, you know, I've been looking for years for a book called The Cocktail Waitress. Could you check his files and see, does he have any correspondence, anything that might give us an idea where we could find it? And 1 week later, I had the manuscript arrive in the mail in an envelope. Guess what I found in a filing cabinet? So that was the light bulb over the head moment. But what I found later was that Cain's papers, after his death, were deposited in the rare manuscript collection at the Library of Congress. And so I took a train down to D.C. and found more than 100 boxes of papers, two of which contained papers related to this book. And it turned out that Cain had written multiple drafts of the book, some incomplete, some complete. And what I ended up having to do was stitch together the optimal draft from pieces of all the different drafts Cain worked on.
The director's cut of Cocktail
Waitress. Right. If only the director had been alive to work with me on it, it would be even more so. But it really was a privilege to do this.
So did you have to do any actual writing?
Yeah, well, look, sometimes when we were stitching together pieces of different drafts, for example, the first draft Cain wrote, he wrote in the third person. Now, Cain was famous for his first-person narration, and he himself decided third-person wasn't working and switched to first. But there were a few scenes in the original third-person draft that were terrific, and it was a shame to lose them, so I put them back in, but some additional writing had to be done to stitch them back in. If nothing else, I had to change all the instances of she to I. But there was a little more than that. I think in the opening 7 chapters, you'd be hard-pressed to find a single word that was original to me. In the closing 7 chapters, by the time you got to the end, Cain himself said in that interview that he was never satisfied with the ending, and the truth is, it needed more work than the beginning did, and so I had to do some additional work there. But it's Cain through and through.
Well, you know, most crime novels, the crime occurs kind of early in the story, and then it's resolved at the end of the story.
Right.
But in this story, the crime and the resolution happened sort of toward the end.
Well, yes and no, right? So I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't read it yet.
We're going to avoid spoilers, of course.
Yes, no spoilers here, but I will say that the book opens with a funeral. So that's not a spoiler. It's on page 1.
Right.
Young woman, beautiful young woman, is burying her husband, and we learn in the first few pages that he was abusive, and he smashed up a car, and he died in a car crash. And one of the questions that remains a question all the way to the end of the book, so it's really not spoiling anything, is was this car crash an accident, or was there the hand of mischief in it? And I think if you conclude at the end of the book that it was an accident, then you're right. There's no crime until the end of the book. If, on the other hand, you choose to believe that the narrator had a hand in it, well, then there's a crime shortly before page one. And that's one of the great things about this book, and the ambiguity of whether you can trust the narrator, who of course presents herself as innocent, or whether you step beyond the page and say, I believe that someone who is guilty of a crime would present herself as innocent. Therefore, this may not be an innocent woman.
Well, of course, one of the trademarks of Cain is that his narrators, they commit crimes in many of the books, in which, as you're listening to them, and this, I guess this is a literary thing that happens, I guess it happens in Lolita, too. That is, as they're committing these terrible crimes, you think, oh, I understand. I would do that, too.
That's right. You know, it's one of the things that drew me to the genre in the first place, and Cain was responsible for it, and one of the younger authors he admired a great deal was Lawrence Block, and Block does this brilliantly, puts you inside the head of a criminal, whether it's a burglar, a killer, what have you, and you come out of the book thinking, well, that's not really such a bad person, is it? You know, and I remember reading Block's burglar books and thinking afterwards, burglary? That's not a bad career. I might like that. No, I was probably 12 at the time, and luckily I didn't go into it. But that's the mark of a great crime writer. You know, it's very easy to write a book where you sympathize with the police officer or the detective. It's really quite hard to make the average non-psychotic person sympathize with a criminal.
And to make it seem like the natural thing that you would do.
Exactly, exactly. Now, there are certainly circumstances where the natural, organic thing one might do is to commit a crime. You know, your loved one is being threatened and you kill in self-defense. But what's harder is to take a truly heinous act and make that seem natural. And Cain does it beautifully. If anyone in your listening audience has not yet read Postman Always Rings Twice or Double Indemnity, those are two of the great reading experiences. Forget the crime genre, period.
They're just great.
100 pages a piece. They're outstanding. You know, it's not an accident that Albert Camus said he was inspired to write L'Étranger in part by reading Postman. It's a tremendous statement of how violence is introduced into the everyday life.
You drop into a cafe, you meet a beautiful woman, before you know it, you're helping her kill her husband.
Exactly, and things never turn out well for you. You know, and that's the wonderful thing about noir fiction, not just Cain. The characters often know it's not going to end well, and they do it anyway. You know, there was a story about Cornell Woolrich, who wrote Rear Window, and is one of the most grim authors ever to pen a novel. And Woolrich told the story of being a child in Mexico and watching a bug trapped under an overturned glass. And he wrote, it tries to crawl up the sides, and it can't, and it can't, and it can't. And that was his summary of the philosophy of noir. We're all bugs trapped under a glass. We don't see the sides. We know we're never going to climb up to the top, but we keep trying and trying and failing. And that's part of what makes noir such an interesting genre, the striving in the face of doom.
We're talking with Charles Ardai, and he is the editor of Hard Case Crime. He's also a novelist, and we're talking about this newly discovered James M. Cain novel. I want to ask you a question that maybe you have a theory about.
Sure.
Why is The Postman Always Rings Twice called The Postman Always Rings Twice? There's no postman, and there's no ringing.
That's right, not even once. Well, there are many stories about it, none of them true, all of them apocryphal. The one true story is that the book was originally submitted under the title Barbecue, and the only connection between that and the book is that the diner where the main character turns up was going to be called Barbecue. And so that would have been a terrible title, not evocative at all, but at least it would have made sense. Postman Always Rings Twice makes no sense. There's the story that gets repeated most often is one about how Cain had submitted the book to his agent or editor, and he was waiting to hear back, and he was in the backyard barbecuing, or God knows what he was doing, but he was waiting to hear the postman ring, and the friend he was with said, are you sure you're going to hear it when the guy comes? And he said, well, yeah, absolutely. He doesn't just ring once, he rings twice. Hey, that's a good idea for a title. That strikes me as the least likely explanation I've ever heard, but I keep hearing it. But I don't have a better one. So if Cain himself told that story, who knows? Maybe it's even true that he lucked into it. but I could not possibly account for it. On the other hand, there's a famous novel in the field called You Play the Red and the Black Comes Up, or maybe it's called You Play the Black and the Red Comes Up. I can never get it straight, and I can't figure out why it's called that. You know, sometimes great titles don't have much to do with the underlying work.
Double Indemnity, which is another wonderful James M. Cain novel, was made into a great film by Billy Wilder with a screenplay by Raymond Chandler. But The Postman Always Rings Twice, it's such a great novel. It's been made into two movies, neither of which was satisfying. Why can't they make a good movie out of that one?
It's a damn good question. Both of the Postman versions, Lana Turner in the 40s and then Jack Nicholson in the late 70s, early 80s, mm-hmm. I enjoyed both of them. But the older one was in a period where you could not display on the screen the kind of raw eroticism and the sort of bleakness that is in the book. So it was probably doomed from the start. By the time you got to, I think it was Bob Raffleson who did it, by the time you got to the Jack Nicholson version, there was plenty of eroticism. That wasn't the problem. But I actually think it may have been, that may have been the problem in the other direction. I think there was so much effort put into the steaminess that you lost the philosophical underpinnings of the book. The reason that Cora wants to murder her husband is not that she's a lustful wench. There's a much more philosophical dimension. She feels this is her one shot to escape a life of not just economic but sort of spiritual poverty, and she knows it's not going to work, but she has to take the shot at it. And I think reducing it to a series of clinches on a kitchen table, it's great that finally Hollywood was willing to make that kind of picture, but it is reductive. I think it makes the story far less interesting. You know, then it turns it into a Cinemax late night cable show. I would love to see somebody give it the kind of treatment that HBO gave to Mildred Pierce recently. I heard some criticism that it was a little dull because it went on for, I think, 6 hours. Fair enough, but it was very faithful, and the philosophy did come through. Now, to be fair, one of the things that makes it possible in Mildred Pierce is that it's not a crime story.
Right.
You know, Mildred Pierce is a purely mainstream story about a woman and her daughter and the terrible things that happen. But I think if you treated Postman in that way, a mainstream story that just happens to include a crime in it, you'd come closest to what makes the book great.
I enjoyed that Mildred Pierce better, more so than I enjoyed the Joan Crawford movie.
Yeah, no, I did too. Even though Kate Winslet could only win an Emmy for it and Crawford won the Oscar, I think Winslet had the better performance.
Yeah, I agree. But this new novel, The Cocktail Waitress, and again, we're going to be careful not to give anything away, but but now in The Postman Always Rings Twice, even now, you read it, you know, and it's been, you know, 80 years almost since it was written, it's shocking. There is shocking sexuality in that book.
Yes.
Whereas this sexuality in The Cocktail Waitress, it's not. It's kind of like past its time rather than ahead of its time.
I think that's a reflection of the fact that the author was 85 when he wrote it. And, you know, a young man writing about things that are scandalous will anticipate. And an old man writing about things that were scandalous when he was young is going to always seem, at best, nostalgic. But I agree with you. I think that when Cain writes about sex in his 80s, it has a slightly uncomfortable flavor of someone's grandfather talking about things you really wish he wouldn't talk about. But the wonderful thing in The Cocktail Waitress is that he incorporates exactly that. I don't know how self-aware he was, but he has the character who is pursuing one of the two men who are pursuing the title character. He makes him an old man. And he, in fact, even gives the old man the same heart ailment that Cain himself was suffering from. And the whole point of that relationship is, in fact, just how creepy and unpleasant it is that this 21-year-old woman finds herself pursued by a much older man who she finds physically repulsive. So I agree with you that that's the flavor of it. But I think Cain, either aware of it or not, takes advantage of that to make it relevant to the plot. You know, there's a wonderful scene where they're in England on a trip, and he has promised he won't touch her and won't do anything inappropriate to her, but of course he doesn't live up to the promise. And her gut-level reaction to his interest, to put it mildly, is one of the I think, one of the best scenes in the book. You know, she's trying to undress, and this old man is groping at her, and it's definitely an unpleasant scene. Of course, that doesn't mean the old man deserves what he gets, but we're not going to talk about what he gets.
No, we're not going to tell that. But, now, there's another eerie thing that happens in The Cocktail Waitress that we can comment about. There is a character in The Cocktail Waitress who is pregnant, and the character is nervous and is taking thalidomide to help calm them down. Of course, now we know that that's one of the absolute worst things you could possibly do.
That's right. Thalidomide was never approved for distribution in the United States, but it did make it into the U.S., of course, and it was approved in the U.K., and the result was thousands of children born with horrific birth defects, truncated limbs, missing limbs, all sorts of horrible birth defects that people reading the book, if it had been published when he wrote it in the 1970s, would have known about. I think today, unless you know somebody who has one of those birth defects and heard the story, I would guess most younger readers probably wouldn't know. And this is why, in the author's note that I appended to the end of the book, several people asked me, could you please put in a paragraph explaining what thalidomide is, because most people won't know. I don't know if most is correct, but in any event, I put it in. It's a little bit like putting a loaded gun on the mantle, to use Chekhov's analogy. You can't mention thalidomide in a novel without it having something of the impact of a loaded gun. You know, it's just such a loaded drug. And I personally like the ending, you know, of the book very much, which, of course, as you say, we're not going to comment on the details of the ending, but there is, but thalidomide plays a role in it. And it's one of the most powerful sections of the book because of it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this book, The Cocktail Waitress, Charles R. Dye. Where would you place it, you know, as you're kind of ranking Kane's works? I mean, we've already talked about the most famous ones, Mildred Pierce, The Postman Always Rings Twice, Double Indemnity. I guess Butterfly is a really famous one.
Right, Serenade is quite famous, or it was in his day. And then there were late novels like The Magician's Wife and Galatea and Mignon that are, frankly, really quite weak. Kane was one of the most varied writers in terms of quality. You know, if you look at Dickens from best to worst, the spread isn't that great. Joseph Heller is an interesting case where he started his career with Catch-22 and everything else was a significant step down. But even Heller, I wouldn't say, has the spread of quality that Kane does. The distance from Kane's best to his worst is quite extraordinary. This is far from the worst, and it is far from the best. It's somewhere in the middle. I would put it in the top third. Since he wrote, 17 books, 18 books? That would mean it's one of the top six, and I think that's about right. I don't think it's going to displace Postman or Double Indemnity as two of the great classics of crime literature. They're safe in their place. But if you think about what the next, and Mildred Pierce, of course, if you think about what the next three would be, I certainly enjoyed it more than Serenade. I enjoyed it at least as much as my next favorite, which might be Jealous Woman. He wrote two, Jealous Woman and Sinful Woman, that are really still wonderful reads. So I would say my next three might be Jealous Woman, Sinful Woman, and Cocktail Waitress. Somewhere in there I'd throw in Love's Lovely Counterfeit, but most intelligent critics don't like it as much as I do, so I'm not going to push the point. But it would be somewhere between number three and number seven on the list of Kane's work, which is really quite strong. By the time you get to the lowest of the list, it was mostly his attempts to write a different kind of fiction. You know, he, I think, aspired to write something more significant with a capital S than crime fiction. And so when he tried to deal with labor unions or the history of the Civil War, it's just not what he was good at. And so when you try to read books like Mignon and Galatea, it's clearly somebody working out of his wheelhouse, and they just don't work.
It's a common problem with some of the great crime novelists that they weren't respected enough because they did crime novels. I mean, I think Dashiell Hammett stopped writing novels early on in his life because he was going to then write something great, but he never did.
Exactly. And frankly, not just crime writers, any writer in genre, science fiction writers are prone to the same affliction. If they don't feel respected for what they've chosen to do, they try to go beyond it. And once in a while, it works really quite beautifully. It also works in the reverse. You know, Philip Roth writes The Plot Against America, which is really, in some respects, a science fiction novel, certainly an alternate history novel. And he gets a great deal of respect from the literary establishment for it, but the science fiction readers turn up their nose and say, you know, who is this carpetbagger coming into our territory and trying to show us how to do it? You know, the stresses between genre and literary fiction have been great throughout history, and if anything, they are less pronounced now, you know, when you have writers who cross between the two, like Michael Chabon, for example. But there's still this sense that if you're only a mystery writer, you aren't quite as much of a writer as you could be. And that was very true in the 30s when Kane became famous. The insults that were heaped on Kane, which you can find online if you do searches for contemporaneous book reviews, are really quite cruel. When you consider that these are books that have stood the test of time and are tremendous reads 80 years later, the opprobrium that was hurled at Postman Always Rings Twice, Time Magazine, you know, referred to it as a garbage heap. It's really, the scorn is undeserved, but can you imagine what that does to an artist who should be proud of his work and instead is forced to bear up under that kind of attack?
And now, speaking of pride, you must be very proud as the editor of Hard Case Crime to have created this book, The Cocktail Waitress. I mean, you didn't write it, but when you're holding it in your hands, it's really a wonderful little work of art. I mean, it looks like it's supposed to look. It's got this great artwork on the cover. And, you know, we talked about this sort of sleazy sex in the book, and that's sleazy, but it's very satisfying. I mean, it's a very...
Oh, I hope so. I'm glad you say that. You know, I have a reading tomorrow in New York at the Strand Bookstore, one of the most famous bookstores in New York.
Acres and acres of books.
I think the slogan's something like a mile of books, miles of books. They're going to have a number of burlesque performers, modern neo-burlesque performers with tassels and pasties and so on, and me, and I'm going to be reading one of the smuttier portions of the Kane book. You know, I am very proud, and thank you for saying that it looks the way it should. We work very hard at Hard Case Crime to keep the look of the old books and to create a physical artifact that resembles the stuff that I loved reading growing up, that my partner Max Phillips, who does the graphic design, also loved when he was a kid. We were both born too late to write books like these for the original publishing houses, so we said, you know what, why don't we start our own? And that's where Hard Case Crime came from. We had no idea whether any reader other than the two of us would want to read these books, but we said, well, let's give it a shot. We thought we would do 6 or 10 books. We have now done close to 100. And the wonderful thing is all these types of art, the types of visual art and the types of storytelling that got criticized for being scandalous back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, now seem quaint and nostalgic and charming and really quite mild when you compare it to the sorts of things that are considered scandalous today. So we have had the good fortune of attracting attention not only from the media but from any number of famous authors and who have been kind enough to write for us, like Stephen King, who's now written 2 books for us. That kind of attention is far beyond anything we could have hoped for. And being able to bring Kane into the list, when I thought originally that there were no more Kane books to publish, that's a privilege beyond words. Seriously, when I was an 18-year-old reading Double Indemnity for the first time, I couldn't have dreamt that one day I would midwife a new Kane novel into print. And in some ways, if it all ended now and I just had this to look at on my shelf, I would feel it was a job well done.
Well, I hope it doesn't all end now, but let me ask you this. When CDs came in, you know, all of a sudden this beautiful album cover art was reduced to the little 5x5 size. And now that CDs are gone and people are just downloading, there's no artwork whatsoever.
Right.
And so now you've got these beautiful books and they're physical. I mean, the way they look, the way they feel, the lettering, the everything is so great. And now the ebook is, you know,
it's
gradually taking over.
Do it well. Look, it's an issue. You know, our books exist as physical artifacts. That's what they're supposed to be. As a concession to the way people like to read books these days, we do put out ebook editions of our new titles, with one exception that I'll mention. But it's not what I care about. It's not what I love. It's really just done as an accommodation for readers who prefer it that way. Some people need the larger font sizes that you can get on an electronic device. I am sympathetic, but it's not something I'd put any effort into. If by pushing one button I can also make it available as an ebook, okay, I'll do it. But it's not what I care about. So as long as Hard Case Crime exists, it's going to exist as a physical line. In the same way that there are still people who are putting out vinyl records today, it's for collectors and passionate aficionados, but it still exists, and maybe Hard Case Crime will exist in that way as a niche product. Now, the one exception is Stephen King's new book, Joyland, which we're publishing next June. He made the decision, we didn't urge him to do this, but he chose to only publish it with us as a paper book. We are not putting out an e-book. Now, eventually, maybe some number of months after we publish it, it may come out as an e-book from some other house, or maybe from us, but for the first, say, 6 months, the only way you'll be able to read Stephen King's new book is in a paper edition, and he did that deliberately because he loved books that felt and looked and smelled like this growing up, and he wants people to have that experience. Of course, there was an outcry immediately as soon as that was announced. Some people said, this is terrible. How could you say that? I don't read paper books anymore. Well, that's your choice, but if you don't read paper books, you're not going to read this book. And I was very proud of him. I was very proud of him for making that decision.
Now, Stephen King, he does write a lot of books, but this book, it's specific to Hard Case Crime. It's a Hard Case Crime story.
It is. It is the story of an amusement park in North Carolina in 1973 and the young man who goes to work there one summer and the quite extraordinary things he discovers.
And is there a supernatural aspect to it, or no, just
there
a crime?
There is. It will not disappoint Mr. King's readers in the slightest in that respect. We have never done a book with an element of the fantastic or supernatural before, and I would have sworn we never would. But the exception is when Stephen King comes to you with a really extraordinary book that does have a supernatural. It's a completely Playfair whodunit. It has a mystery element that is completely straight, but there's also an element of a ghost story. And I guarantee you that the stock of whatever corporation manufactures Kleenex tissues is going to go up through the roof when this book comes out, because it is a heartbreaker. If you're not crying when you read the last page, you are the most hard-hearted soul on the planet.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Now, Charles Ardye, you're also a novelist, and you've written half a dozen novels or something.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working on now?
Over the last 3 years, I haven't published a book of my own, and it's because I've been working on a TV series called Haven, which is, in fact, based on the first book that Stephen King wrote for Hard Case Crime called The Colorado Kid. Haven went on the air 3 years ago. The third season is on Sci-Fi now, Friday nights at 10. And it's just been getting better and better. I have the good fortune to be able to work on the show as a consulting producer and as a writer. And so the time I would have spent writing novels has turned into consulting on the scripts for the show and writing some myself. It is a great pleasure. It's something I had never done before and always wanted to. The book was very different from the show, both excellent, very different from one another. The show does have supernatural elements to it. And since it was just renewed for a fourth season last week, I suspect I'm going to not write another book next year. But Haven won't be on the air forever, because nothing ever is. Even MASH went off the air after 12 years. and I do look forward to writing the next novel. I just don't know when I'll get the time to do it.
Well, let me ask you a question about Haven. Do you have is there a master plan for Haven? I mean, I guess as long as the show gets renewed, it'll continue. But do you have, like, an ending? I mean, is there a...
Yes. The two men who created the mythos of the show, Sam Ernst and Jim Dunn, had a very clear plan of where the story starts and ends. And by the end of this season, season three, actually quite a lot of the open questions that people are wondering about will be answered. It's not like Lost, where it went on, and by season seven, no answers were there. People will understand, for example, who murdered the Colorado Kid and why by the end of season three, but that doesn't mean there aren't plenty more questions left. So I think this could easily be, if the network permits, a seven-season show, an eight-season show, who knows, maybe even more. But if we knew for sure that it was going to end in less time, I'm sure they could telescope the remaining story and make sure that the ending is a satisfying one.
Well, my guest has been Charles Ardye. He is a writer, and he is the founder and editor of Hard Case Crime, and their latest publication, I believe it's the latest one, is mm-hmm. The Cocktail Waitress, an undiscovered, previously unpublished novel by James M. Cain. Charles Ardye, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page, fromthebookshelf.com. Subscribe to the podcast at iTunes and visit us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Charles Ardye. He is the publisher of Hard Case Crime, their latest publication, a newly discovered James M. Cain novel, The Cocktail Waitress. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. I'll see you next time.